the chair of the Religious Studies of Graceland College. He was unable to make it, so that paper will be read by Melvin Smith. And then we'll go from there.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to substitute for Bill. Being a fellow marathoner, it's nice to be able to beat him once in a while. Jeff Lundgren, the self-proclaimed prophet, as mass murderer. Bill says, I am writing a book on the split that has occurred in the RLDS Church since the 1984 revelation permitting the ordination of women. I have identified over 200 local groups of RLDS members who have begun meeting separately from the RLDS Church. Most of these are what are called independent restoration branches. They are independent of the RLDS hierarchy's control. They preach the pure restoration gospel as they see it, and they do everything a local branch can do, including calling men to the priesthood up to but not beyond the office of elder. In general, they are waiting for God to act with regard to calling another prophet or straightening out the liberal RLDS prophet Wallace B. Smith. On the extreme fringe of this schism are several men who have stepped forward to proclaim themselves as prophet. None have rallied a large following. Two are currently in jail. One, Gene Walton, is limited to proselyting his fellow inmates because he refuses to pay alimony to his ex-wife. But by far the best known self-proclaimed prophet, is the other jailbird, Jeff Lundgren, who is currently on trial in Painesville, Ohio, for mass murder. Since I am a so-called expert witness for the defense, I am not able to be with you today. I have, however, appointed a capable person to share my information with you. Give ear to what he says, hear ye him. And if you know, know Bill, it's more important that he says that than that you hear it. Jeff Lundgren is a native of Independence, Missouri, who recently gathered a community of disciples in Kirtland, Ohio. While his following was never more than two or three dozen people, he became nationally known when in early January of 1990, he was charged with the murders of a family of five in Kirtland. 12 other people were indicted, including his wife, Alice, and his son, Damon. Jeff's parents and his maternal grandparents, who lived next door, were very devout members of the RLDS Church. The family attended the Slover Park Congregation in Independence, where Grant McMurray, whom some of you know, was a member. For the Lundgrens, life revolved around the church. Jeff graduated from William Chrisman High School in 1968, a classmate of Bob Mesley's, whom some of you know, I think. He enrolled in the Central Missouri State University. He dropped out before the end of his second year at CMSU, married, and soon began a four-year hitch in the United States Navy beginning in November of 1970. Lundgren married Alice Keeler on May the 5th, 1970. Their first of four children, son Damon, was born 7 months later on December the 12th, 1970. Three more children followed, Jason in 1974, Chris in 1979, and Caleb in 1980. After his discharge from the Navy in November of 1974, Lundgren returned to CMSU to work toward his degree. He got to within a term of graduation and dropped out. He never completed his degree. Jeff had difficulty keeping a job for long. By the early 1980s, his family was living in Independence. They began attending the Slover Park congregation again. On that first day back, Ray Treat, a Book of Mormon enthusiast, was conducting a series of lectures on the Book of Mormon. Treat introduced Lundgren to the literary device known as chiasmus, wherein a statement has a center point and the two halves of the statement are a mirror image of each other, like we don't eat to live but live to eat. That's a chiasmic phrase. Some Book of Mormon enthusiasts claim that this phenomena is common in the Old Testament and also in the Book of Mormon. Hence, Book of Mormon enthusiasts in the LDS and RLDS tradition sometimes cite the existence of chiasmus in the Book of Mormon as one evidence of Hebraic influence in the Book of Mormon, and thus helps prove that what most Mormons believe, that the Book of Mormon is a historical account of ancient people. Like his parents and grandparents, Jeff Lundgren was numbered among those RLDS who were fundamentalists or conservative on matters of church doctrine. He was not happy with the movement of the church away from the traditional, uniquely Mormon themes toward mainstream Protestantism. As a strong believer in the Book of Mormon, Jeff was one of many RLDS members who was concerned that the church leadership seemed to be playing down the Book of Mormon. Thus, it is not surprising that he was attracted to the phenomena of chiasmus. And like other conservative RLDS members, he was not in agreement when the 1984 World Conference President, action of World President Wallace B. Smith, when he announced and the conference approved a revelation in which the ordination of women was to be permitted in the church. This doctrine was canonized as the 156th section of the RLDS Doctrine and Covenants. In the meantime, Lundgren's study of the RLDS scriptures led him to the conclusion that Christ was going to return to Kirtland, where the only RLDS temple is located, and not to Independence, as many RLDS members, especially in times past, have believed. He concluded that God intended for the early saints to stay in Kirtland and not move west. He was impressed by the Go to Kirtland passage of the Doctrine and Covenants, and also the Book of Mormon passage is about seeing and feeling Christ. He applied to Ken Stobaugh, and in August 1984, 4 months after the World Conference had approved Section 156, Jeff Lundgren moved his family to Kirtland, where he began his work as a full-time volunteer tour guide for the Kirtland Temple. There he hoped that the temple environment would be the place where he would be able to prepare himself to actually see Christ. He worked under the direction of Bill Lord, director of the Kirtland Temple Historical Center. While Lundgren's job was essentially that of volunteer, as a tour guide, he was given a free apartment near the temple, but there was no salary. He was able to receive financial support from various friends who supported him in his work. Bill Lord recalls that in his first months on the job, Jeff Lundgren was fully cooperative and seemed to have a solid base in scriptures. The temple tours he conducted for visitors were all right as far as Lord could tell. Eventually, Lundgren was second in command at the center, being the person in charge when Lord was absent. But Lord believes that eventually Lundgren began to get a little carried away in his interpretation of some of the symbols of the temple as he made connection between certain temple symbols and the archaeological ruins of Central America, which some people link to the Book of Mormon. He also made links to Solomon's temple. When Lundgren began his work in the temple, he was soon impressed with the symmetry found in its architecture, and he therefore considered the temple to be chiastic also. The church leadership in Kirtland seemed to have no problem with him at first. The stake president, when he arrived, was Seeb Morgan. He had no real conflict with Lundgren. Then Dale Luffman arrived as the new Kirtland stake president in January of 1986. Having a divinity degree from Princeton, Luffman soon was in conflict with Lundgren. In mid-January, Luffman preached about love. Lundgren thought Luffman was ignoring other requirements of the gospel, like obedience to the law. Internal conflict within the church in Kirtland was nothing new. There had been long been tensions between church members at Kirtland and the world church leadership in Independence. The major source of conflict has been over the Kirtland Temple. For many years, the local congregation of the church held their regular worship services at the temple. But in 1959, the world church leaders decided not to permit the local congregation to meet there anymore. A church was built across the street from the temple for the local congregation. The temple would be used primarily as a historic site with occasional special meetings permitted. For a special meeting at the temple, one was to have to get approval from the office of the First Presidency in Independence. The Kirtland Saints resented getting evicted from the temple. The stake president and bishop, being outsiders, appointed by the leadership in Independence, were in natural conflict with the local saints over this. When Luffman arrived, that's the stake president, in January 1986, Jeff Lundgren was teaching a Sunday evening class on the Book of Mormon in response to requests from members that he instruct them. Many Kirtland Saints were rather fundamental in their theology and were impressed at Lundgren's knowledge of the Book of Mormon. But Luffman was not impressed with Lundgren and got him removed from the evening class. Bill Lord, Lundgren's boss at the Kirtland Temple Historic Center, recalls that Lundgren preached twice at the Kirtland congregation. Both of his sermons were on repentance. Lord recalls telling Lundgren after his second sermon that he had probably preached his last sermon in the Kirtland congregation. Lord was right. Dale Luffman saw to it that Jeff Lundgren did not preach there again. But while Luffman was at the RLDS World Conference in Independence, Missouri in April 18, 1986, a troublesome change was made in the Sunday school program at Kirtland. The person who was teaching the Sunday morning adult church school class turned it over to Jeff Lundgren for the purpose of studying Isaiah. Isaiah is a good way to get lots of Book of Mormon questions, since the relationship of the two writings is close. So Lundgren had an opportunity to continue teaching about the Book of Mormon, and now he had the prime church school hour each Sunday morning. The class had about 25 to 30 attendees on the average. One of the leaders of the fundamentalist faction in the class, Vince Majewski, began audio taping the class sessions. The class was being attended by several persons later indicted in the Avery murders: Dennis and Tonya Patrick, Richard Brand, Daniel Kraft, and Sharon Blunsley. Attendees also included several members who later became part of the schismatic fundamentalist group in Kirtland: Alan Plow, Vincent Majewski, John Collin, Larry and Carla Gray, Carol and Mary Fenner, and Leroy and Edith Klein. While Jeff Lundgren and his family were living in the free apartment behind the Kirtland Temple Historic Center, he attracted the first disciple who came to live with him in Kirtland. That disciple was Kevin Curry. Curry had been a friend of Lundgren's in the Navy. Lundgren had converted Curry to the RLDS Church. The second person to move in with the Lundgren family was Richard V. Brand, who had known Jeff from the Independence area. Then came Daniel Kraft, who grew up in Nauvoo and converted to the RLDS Church. Sharon Blunsley was the next person to move in with the Lundgrens. When Dale Luftman arrived in January 1986, the state president, Blunsley was teaching the Book of Mormon class at the Kirtland congregation. Alice Lundgren was the church school director, and the Book of Mormon was being taught at all age levels in the church. For children, these classes were being taught instead of the regular RLDS World Church curriculum offerings for the various age levels. In one class, according to Dale Luftman, the children were told to pray real hard for Mr. Wallace B. Smith, the church president, and the stake president, because they are destroying the church. In addition to these unmarried people who lived in the church-owned housing, three couples were attracted to Lundgren's teachings and moved from Independence to Kirtland: Dennis and Cheryl Avery, now deceased; Dennis and Tonya Patrick; and Ron and Susan Love. Jeff Lundgren had been called to the office of priest rather late, at the age of 33. When Dale Luftman became stake president, he found a recommendation for Jeff Lundgren to be called to the office of elder, and that it was in process within the stake. Having got a taste of Lundgren's fundamentalistic, legalistic understanding of the gospel, Luftman, a strong believer in the Pauline grace, blocked the recommendation. Lundgren was never ordained an elder. It took some time for Dale Luftman to relieve Jeff Lundgren from his Isaiah class. Approximately a year later, in the spring of 1987, the last class was held. At that time, Jeff was invited to continue teaching the course at his house in Kirtland. Jeff taught it twice at the Clough home, but decided to quit when Dale Luftman complained about it. At this point, Lundgren was still a temple guide and probably thought that it was important not to antagonize Luftman in order to retain that job. At that time, it does not appear that Lundgren was perceived as a serious problem by the people responsible for the Kirtland Temple tours. While some complaints had been received, Historic Site Director for the RLDS, Ken Stobaugh, and the Director of the Kirtland Temple Historic Center, Bill Lord, did not perceive them as serious. Lundgren continued to be Bill Lord's second-in-command at the center. In September 1986, for example, about 75 members of the John Whitmer Historical Association came to Kirtland for their annual meeting. The leading RLDS historians and a handful of LDS historians were on hand for the meetings. Bill Lord was on vacation. He left Jeff Lundgren in charge of giving the tour to the JWHA members. The JWHA members did not perceive anything strange or bizarre in this tour. This writer, meaning Bill Russell, remembers almost nothing of that tour. The situation finally came to a head, however, in July of 1987. A caravan of high school youth from northwest Iowa were visiting the historic sites of the church. Led by a church appointee and a patriarch, the visitors were shocked by some of the statements Lundgren made, which included that the idea that we have not had a legitimate prophet since Joseph Smith, Jr. The following month, August 1987, a question arose as to whether Jeff Lundgren had appropriated for his personal use some of the funds that come into the Kirtland Temple Historic Center. Receipts had been below normal for some time, and it looked suspicious. The records were damaged in a flood in the basement, and so it was impossible to prove the suspicion. The end result was that on August the 14th, 1987, Jeff Lundgren was notified that he would no longer be a temple guide after September the 30th, and that he had until October the 31st to vacate the church-owned home he was living in. So in the fall of 1987, with his free housing at an end, Lundgren rented a farm outside of Kirtland. The single people in his clan moved out of the farm with him, while the married ones, Dennis and Cheryl Avery, Ron and Susan Luff, and Dennis and Tonya Patrick, got housing of their own. Lundgren was removed from his priestess office by the initiative of State President Luffman on January the 29th, 1988. So by the end of January 1988, Jeff Lundgren was silenced from the priesthood and had been removed from his temple job and church-owned home. He was living on the farm with his followers and becoming more and more unorthodox in his thought and action. By this time, he was telling his disciples to withdraw their LDS membership, although he did not withdraw his own membership until October 1988. People who gathered to the commune were expected to turn over their possessions to Jeff Lundgren. The men took jobs in the area and turned over their paychecks to Lundgren, who they called Father or Prophet. Reports from cult members and from members of their families suggest that Lundgren led the group not only in scripture study, but also in regular paramilitary maneuvers. He required members to participate in regimented calisthenics. He threatened to kill those who spoke of leaving the commune. Lundgren controlled the purse strings. Cult member Deborah Olivares gave Lundgren a total of approximately $37,000. Daniel Kraft told the FBI that he gave Lundgren more than $14,000 in 1988. Sharon Blunsley told the FBI she handed over all of her $120 per week check to Lundgren. Kevin Curry turned over his paycheck from the Veterans Administration Psychiatric Hospital near Cleveland. At least by early 1988, rumors began to circulate that Lundgren planned an armed takeover of the Kirtland Temple to, quote, eradicate the unrighteous, end of quote, on May the 3rd, which happened to be his birthday. These sources claimed that those who lived within a block of the temple would be decapitated. The RLDS meeting hall across the street from the temple would be burned. RLDS leaders like Dale Luffman would be assassinated, and a disruption of the police response was planned. Thus, the righteous, quote-unquote, would be in control of the temple and Christ would return. Christ's return would bring the destruction of everything unholy. Paul Wensky of the Kansas City Times reported that Lundgren taught that, quote, an earthquake would unleash a fury on the earth, but a gigantic mountain would rise up from the devastation with the Kirtland Temple balanced on the top and with Lundgren and his group safe inside, end of quote. According to Stake President Luffman, Lundgren preached that Jesus would destroy not anyone not inside the Kirtland Temple. Kevin Curry said that Lundgren, quote, began to think of the land around the temple as a vineyard that had to be cleansed to raise it up on a mountain and present it to the Lord. He began to prepare us for the cleansing of the vineyard, and that included physical training, battle tactics, and learning about the weapons that we had on hand. He planned to go into these homes and cleanse the vineyard by decapitating the members of the family. He one night quite graphically described what that would mean in terms of loss of blood. End of quote. Persons who left the commune or who were close to members of the commune asserted that Lundgren claimed a revelation which held that 10 persons would have to die to purify their community. Then they would be able to go into the wilderness where they would further purify themselves and prepare to see and feel Jesus Christ. They also hoped to receive the golden sword and the lost plates containing sacred scriptures not presently known to humankind. The golden sword was apparently the sword of Laban, the sword which in the Book of Mormon is stolen from its owner Laban and used to decapitate Laban. The murderer, Nephi, then steals the plates containing Hebrew scriptures and takes justification from these crimes, namely, quote, better that one man perish than a whole nation dwindle in unbelief, end of quote. Troubled by the violent plans unfolding, Lundgren's Navy friend from Buffalo, Kevin Curry, determined to leave the commune. Not wanting Lundgren to suspect he was leaving for fear that of what he would do, Curry boarded a bus in the middle of his workday. He left with only the clothes on his back. Curry was the first person to notify the authorities of Lundgren's apparent violent plans. He contacted the FBI and the Curtin police chief, Dennis Yarborough. Robert Hoyles of the Akron Beacon Journal reports that the Curtin police, quote, received a tip on April the 28, 1988, that Lundgren had planned to take over the Kirtland Temple on May the 3rd, his birthday, and kill church leaders, including Luffman, end of quote. The Kirtland police began to watch the commune. They paid a visit to the commune a few days prior to the planned May 3rd attack on the temple. The police visit and a May 3rd trip to the woods for meditation by Lundgren apparently caused him to decide the time was not right for a takeover of the temple. On April the 18th, 1989, now this is a year later, about 20 FBI agents and Kirtland police visited the commune and questioned Lundgren. With five bodies buried in the barn murdered the night before, Lundgren and other residents denied having any violent tendencies. There was no plans to take over the temple by force, they claimed. The authorities did notice a store of weapons, but there were no illegal weapons. They were not able to get evidence that amounted to probable cause for an arrest. Somewhere along the line, Lundgren concluded that God only required that five persons needed to die to purify the community. Lundgren determined that the five who would have to die would be Dennis and Cheryl Avery and their three daughters, Trina 15, Rebecca 13, and Karen 7. Possibly we'll never know why Lundgren chose the Averys. Some persons felt that Lundgren regarded the Averys as well as Dennis and Tonya Patrick as being expendable. He apparently regarded both men as weak in their male role as head of their family. Apparently, Jeff Lundgren clashed with Cheryl Avery and considered her a bossy woman whose husband was weak and unable to keep her in line. On April the 17th, 1989, they withdrew their three daughters from school. That night, they were all dead, murdered with a .45 caliber handgun and buried in the barn on the farm. The next day, April the 18th, 1989, about 20 FBI agents and Kirtland police visited the Lundgren commune and interrogated its residents. Quote, we interviewed every member who lived in the house, said Lloyd Buck, an FBI agent in Painesville. There were threats being made against certain church members in Kirtland and Kansas City. There was information that members of this house were going to kill members of the church, end of quote. Officials feared on a May 3rd armed takeover of the Kirtland Temple and the murder of church leaders. Cult members interviewed told the authorities that Jeff Lundgren would never harm anyone. When questioned, Richard Brand admitted that he was familiar with the stories from the Book of Mormon that might sound similar to the alleged Kirtland takeover. But he said these stories could never be justification for murdering people. He said that nothing in the church law allows murder. Damon Lundgren said his father shot people while serving in the U.S. Navy in Vietnam, but that was because they were shooting at him. He told the FBI one day after the murders, for which he was later indicted, wrestling in the backyard is the most violent thing we ever did. Daniel Kraft said that Lundgren is a very caring and loving and sharing person. The authorities found a dozen guns, but none were illegal. There were seven high-powered guns, including an AR-15 machine gun, 4,000 rounds of ammunition, camouflage uniforms, gas masks, portable radios, and a stun gun. Explaining the arsenal of weapons, Lundgren told the FBI that he had continued his father's tradition of collecting guns and that he was an avid shooter. Kraft told the authorities that Lundgren wore camouflage clothing because it is so comfortable. He said the group watched violent movies such as Rambo and Highlander, but such movies held no significance to their religious practices. Lundgren explained that all of his followers had pulled their children out of school and were moving to California. He told the FBI they would re-enroll their children there. His son Damon was a senior at Kirtland High School just a few weeks away from graduation. In a statement to the FBI, Lundgren indicated that shortly after the return of Christ, there will be a cataclysmic event such as an earthquake. His followers will be ready. Lundgren and his group of about 20 left the farm within hours of the FBI questioning and moved to Davis, West Virginia, where they lived in tents in the wilderness. having purified their community with the murder of the Averys, they went to West Virginia in search of a sign that would lead them to come into the presence of Christ and to find the golden sword, which would protect themselves from the end of the world and find the lost plate. Buried with the sword would be the sacred writings, hidden tablets mentioned by Joseph Smith in the 1820s, containing the wisdom needed to convert the world to Lundgren's cult. But they didn't find Jesus Christ, the golden sword, or the lost plates. In late September or early October, they left West Virginia and moved to Chilihowie, Virginia. I hope that's how you pronounce that. Chilihowie, a rural community about 45 miles southeast of Kansas City. They settled on a farm south of town owned by Mel Lanius. They told a neighbor they were going to build Mount Zion, which they said was a kingdom in the Bible that people had been trying to build for 10,000 years. By December 1989, the commune had broken up. Jeff Lundgren had taken Keith's wife, Kathy Johnson, as his second wife, even though she was still married to Keith. Kathy was pregnant and bore Jeff Lundgren's daughter on June the 19th, 1990. Keith Johnson was a longtime friend of the Lundgrens. In late December, the Kirtland police received a call from Avery relatives who were inquiring about their whereabouts. They had thought Dennis and Cheryl and their three daughters had moved to Wyoming in April, but not having heard anything from them, even at Christmas, made them suspicious. Stake President Dale Luffman was asked if he knew their whereabouts. He did not. Then on New Year's Eve, Kathy Johnson's husband, Keith, informed federal agents, this would be 1989, informed federal agents in Kansas City, Missouri, that the bodies of five people lay buried in the farm outside Kirtland. The federal agents were skeptical at first and then notified Kirtland police. They began the search, and on Wednesday, January the 3rd, they found the body of Dennis Avery. The next day, they unearthed the bodies of the other four Averys. Each of the Averys had been shot. The faces, hands, and feet of all of them had been bound with duct tape. 13 arrest warrants were issued promptly, and most of the suspects were soon in custody. Five members of the commune were indicted for murder: Jeff Lundgren, his 19-year-old son Damon, David Brand, 26, Daniel Kraft, 24, and Ronald Luff, 29, were indicted on five counts of aggravated murder and kidnapping. Eight others were indicted on five counts of conspiracy and complicity to commit aggravated murder and five counts of kidnapping. The eight were Alice Lundgren, 38, Catherine Johnson, 36, Gregory Winship, 29, Sharon Jean Blunchley, 31, Dennis Patrick, 35, Tonya J. Patrick, 33, Deborah Sue Olivares, 37, and Susan L. Luff, 31. These charges have been dismissed against Kathy Johnson and Dennis and Tonya Patrick, who were not at the farm on the night of the murders. But they have been indicted for a conspiracy to take over the Kirtland Temple. The only trial held so far was Alice Lundgren. A Lake County, Ohio jury found her guilty of all 15 counts against her. At the time of this writing, the judge has not sentenced her. Her husband's trial started August the 13th of this month and should run about 6 weeks. Richard Brand, Greg Winship, Debbie Olivares, Sharon Blunchley, and Susan Luff have plea bargained. I presume they will all testify against Jeff Lundgren. Damian Lundgren, Ronald Luff, Daniel Kraft, all charged with first-degree murder, are awaiting trial. This paper has probably exceeded the timeline, and I would prefer to limit mine out after the trial, since I am a defense witness. Thank you.
Okay, now listed guilt by association or innocence by proclamation in the churning wake of a media crisis by Rebecca Chandler. I don't personally know Rebecca, but I've got some biographical information that she graduated from BYU undergraduate and master's and has taught at in the Jordan District, at BYU, several public school systems in California, New Jersey, and Ohio, and at Laurel School at Cleveland State University, right? That's a private girls' college preparatory school, and has written several articles in Exponent 2, Ensign, and a short story in the New Era, and edited a Kirtland issue of Exponent 2. She presented this paper in Washington, D.C. in April of 1980, and this is the same paper that you're reading. Okay. So now we'll listen to that, and we'll have questions afterwards.
The discovery of five bodies in a Kirtland barn, the arrest and now trials of the 13 cult members who were responsible, has been big news in northeastern Ohio ever since the story first broke on January 4th of this year. As I left Cleveland to attend this conference, Jeffrey Lundgren's trial was finally getting underway, despite attempts by his lawyers to obtain a change of venue. They have argued that because of extensive media coverage, he cannot possibly have a fair trial in Lake County. Of 201 Lake County residents questioned, all 201 had heard of Lundgren and his activities. Fully 70% wanted him put to death. The survey itself was deemed unprofessional and inconclusive, but it resulted in a subpoena of local television, radio, and newspaper representatives to document for the record the amount of publicity given to the Lundgren case. As of Friday, August 10th, there had been 1,786 news accounts, including 492 television reports, 944 radio broadcasts, and 350 newspaper stories. It is of concern to Latter-day Saints living in the area that a fair number of these stories have linked the Jeffrey Lundgren and his cult members and his activities in some way to the Mormon Church. The first sketchy reports indicated that Lundgren had formerly been a Mormon and that the lives of local Mormon leaders had been threatened. That very understandable confusion between the LDS and the RLDS churches was cleared up almost immediately and has not been a problem since. It was in the search for related feature material that reporters, especially staff writers for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, bumped into Mormon culture and Mormon doctrine for the reasons that are not very surprising either. At the time of his arrest, Lundgren had, along with an incredible arsenal of weapons, a Book of Mormon in his possession. Reporters had become intrigued with the puzzle of why this horrible thing had happened, and had wondered if perhaps there wasn't something in Mormon doctrine or practices that encouraged members to follow a recognized leader without question and to execute any commandment that he might issue. Was there something in the Book of Mormon itself that encouraged or condoned ritual violence? When interviewed, former cult members indicated that Lundgren had often quoted from Nephi, "It is better that one man perish than that a nation dwindle in unbelief." Five members of the Avery family had apparently become victims of some twisted application of that passage of Scripture. The Plain Dealer quoted this passage and other scriptures in which the sword of Laban figured prominently. On January 13th, two staff writers, Michael Norman and John S. Long, co-authored a feature on the slayings that described the doctrine of blood atonement as taught by Brigham Young. And that article was followed on January 25th and January 26th by two very lengthy pieces that ran as a two-part series on the cult phenomenon in general and on cults with roots in Mormonism in particular. There was also an article setting forth RLDS claims that their doctrine, theology, liturgy, and history are far more mainline than those of the Utah Church. It was in researching these stories that Michael Norman ran across my husband, whose book, Benediction, had recently been published and reviewed by a staff writer of the Associated Press and had been released to the AP Wire. Neil was willing enough to talk with him and found him very well prepared for the interview. He was aware of the well-publicized Lafferty and LeBaron cases and had spoken with Sandra Tanner in Salt Lake City and with Jan Shipps in Bloomington, Indiana. In addition to blood atonement, he was aware of the violent gestures that at that time still accompanied various oaths and covenants in the temple ceremony. And he even asked if there weren't a teaching in our church that when the leaders had spoken, the thinking had been done. Neil did what he could to stem the tide, reminding Norman that Lundgren had no historical allegiance to Brigham Young, and that ours is a church that has always championed education and free exercise of individual agency. While most of what Neil said never actually appeared in print, the resulting article was, we felt, relatively balanced, with no outrageous assertions or major inaccuracies, except that the membership of the church was pegged at 3.5 million instead of the 7 million that we claimed as of 1989. The story itself ran on the front page, as related stories had for over 2 weeks, and the inside page spread included a picture of Neil looking thoughtful and concerned with the following cut line. Mormon author Neil Chandler, coordinator of the creative writing program at Cleveland State University, has come to dread the reports of cults with ties to Mormonism because of the misunderstandings they generate about his faith. Unfortunately, the page layout juxtaposed that picture with one of Irvrel LeBaron, looking depraved and demented, with a caption referring to his conviction in the 1977 shooting death of Utah polygamist leader Rulon Allred. But you can't really blame a reporter for what layout digs out of the files. Our rather sanguine attitude was not shared by the membership of the church at large or by local church officials, who were chagrined that there had been any association at all suggested between mainline Mormonism and the actions of radical excommunicants of another church. Missionary referrals, we were later told, dropped dramatically, and convert baptisms, never statistically impressive in the Kirtland stake, were running at 50% of what might normally be expected. Interestingly, as preoccupied with the situation as church members were, it was absolutely never discussed in church, from the pulpit or in quorum meetings, throughout the four or five area stakes, until a Kirtland Stake leadership conference on February 2nd, when President Zane Lee broke the silence and addressed the issue frontally. The stake leadership was concerned about false and misleading newspaper stories and had contacted Jack Anderson, church public relations director in Salt Lake City, for advice. They had also contacted the Plain Dealer to voice their displeasure. Church members were to be comforted. These were trying times, but the gospel was true. Members were to refer all requests for information or opinions from the media to a newly appointed stake public communications director. It was also announced that there would be a media offensive, which would include a number of special activities to which the media would be invited, and a special Plain Dealer supplement, which would feature the family of Corey Snyder, right fielder for the Cleveland Indians and a member of the Cleveland Stake. It was hoped that this approach would help recoup what the leadership felt had surely been lost over the incident and perhaps mitigate or at least balance whatever poor publicity was yet to come. The following morning, fast meetings were held throughout the stake, and several members in several wards referred to the situation in some way in their testimonies. One sister in my ward proclaimed these to be the last days and said it had been prophesied that Latter-day persecution would begin in Kirtland. She did not cite references. This was it, she said. We were on the cutting edge of Armageddon. Now, I have recounted all of this not because I'm particularly interested in cults or even in media perception of cults and Mormonism, but because I'm interested in Mormons and in their reactions to public scrutiny. It would be a clear understatement to assert that the church, since its inception, has had intermittent public relations problems. Indeed, much of the 19th century persecutions either originated with or were aggravated by attacks in local newspapers. A better historian than I could probably show that at times the persecution was exacerbated by official and member overreaction to media attacks. What I would like to do is simply look at two national media crises within my own adult lifetime and at how those crises have affected us institutionally and personally. I think there are lessons to be drawn for the present unpleasantness. The crises to which I refer, and by crises I mean those situations which received widespread and prolonged and negative attention, are the boycott of BYU athletic teams in 1970 by many schools in the Western Athletic Conference, and the resulting charges that the church theology and policies promoted racism, and secondly, the excommunication of political activist Sonia Johnson in 1979, coupled with the visible and official Mormon lobbying against the Equal Rights Amendment and the resulting charges that ours was a patriarchally repressive church. You may be able to add to this list other situations you recall, perhaps local issues that affected smaller groups of church members, but that perhaps affected them all the more dramatically because they were close by, just as the Kirtland killings have affected us in northeastern Ohio. When church members feel that they are being attacked for whatever reason, the most elemental, most natural, and by far the most widespread reaction is defensiveness. Sometimes this is accompanied, I've noticed, by bewilderment. How can people say such things about us when we are such nice people? We are God-fearing, upright individuals who spend our lives doing genealogy and compassionate service and going to meetings. Why can't they leave us alone? Why don't they ever print the good news about us? Defensiveness sometimes takes the form of anger, even outrage. I spoke with a member of the Kirtland Stake leadership who expressed this point of view. Newspaper reporters ought to know better. They are professional journalists, and they should be aware of the church as a worldwide presence that couldn't possibly have ties to anything that happened out there in that barn. Stake leaders were also resentful that they themselves had not been contacted for comment when these stories were prepared. Why had reporters spoken only to non-Mormons or to excommunicated Mormons? I don't know into which of these two categories they place my husband. Newspaper publishers are greedy. They just want to sell papers. They don't care if they're being fair or whom they hurt. It's all filthy lucre. Our good friend Keith Norman was upset. He wrote a reasoned and, I thought, persuasive six-page letter to the editor of The Plain Dealer, pointing out that the Mormons hadn't exactly invented violence, and suggesting that it might be as profitable to blame the Catholics, who, after all, conducted the Inquisition, or even the Jews, who ran the show in the Old Testament, where stories of violence figure prominently. His letter was returned with thanks and apologies that there had not been space available to print it. There must have been other letters written and submitted, but one of the few published is, I think, instructive. Quote, I am a native-born Clevelander. I have earned a bachelor's degree in psychology, a master's degree in U.S. history, teaching certificates in social studies and in learning disabilities, and I am working on a second master's degree in education. In spite of all of this, I am a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I did the majority of my coursework at Cleveland State University because of a high grade point average awarded a graduate internship. All this in spite of the fact that I am a Mormon. I work for Cuyahoga Community College, where I develop and implement special education and training programs for our inner-city youth. I also teach history at the western campus of Tri-C. In addition, I own and operate a successful private tutoring agency. All this in spite of my activities as an active member of the Mormon Church. After going on to assert, without documentation of any kind, that Mormons have the highest per capita income in the state of Ohio, a statistical profile that could not possibly have included my ward, and that our church has more doctors, more lawyers, and more Cleveland Indians than anyone else in the area, he denies unequivocally all charges. Mormons are peace-loving. They do not, never have, never would, never could, teach or subscribe to anything like a doctrine of blood atonement, and the temple ceremony is completely peaceful. To suggest otherwise is total sacrilege. While this gentleman, whom I do not know, the address given is outside of my stake, may be commended for putting on the whole armor of God, for not being ashamed of his church, and for being willing to leap to its defense, there are problems with his printed protestation. Many members, and I suspect many more non-members, were offended by the self-congratulation and the condescension in his letter. Moreover, there are serious problems with accuracy in the financial profile he projects, and more importantly, in the denials he sets forth. It does not take a great deal of historical research to unearth disturbing references to or proclamations of blood atonement. Indeed, such pronouncements are far more easily explained in the context of the times, the tribulations, and the temperaments of the men who delivered them than they are disavowed. And as secret and as sacred as we like to think the temple ceremony is, it is remarkably easy to obtain a fairly complete and accurate description of what goes on behind those walls. The penalty oaths, only recently removed from the temple ceremony, were still in place at the time these articles were written, and were, in fact, only a vestige of various oaths to avenge the blood of Joseph Smith and other LDS martyrs that were once a part of the temple endowment, and that were, in fact, echoed in many of our latter-day hymns until the most recent revision of the hymnal. To deny that such ever existed doesn't change the facts. A particularly Mormon manifestation of this very natural defensiveness is a posture that recalls the persecutions of earlier days. This is the work of Satan. Newspaper and television reporters, possibly unwittingly, but nevertheless in all actuality, have become tools of the devil. The whole atrocity was concocted solely to keep the work of the kingdom from rolling forth. Well, perhaps. But these are serious charges. And before we lay satanic discipleship at the foot of a journalist who may, in fact, simply be doing his job and trying to meet his deadline, there are some things to consider. Perhaps some of us feel a little cheated at having missed the major persecutions of a century ago. Perhaps we feel a kind of survivor's guilt about the tarrings and featherings, the Hans Mill massacre, the expulsion from Nauvoo, and the trek across the plains. We feel ourselves deeply indebted to those who have gone before and a nagging insecurity about ourselves. How would we have fared in the face of such trials? Perhaps we concoct, for example, trials of our own, early morning seminary, road shows, ward building committees, so that we can have an occasion to rise to. And we can always comfort ourselves with the knowledge that in the last days, the real trials will really come and we will yet get our chance. So we are always watching and waiting, and I think often finding persecution where none was ever intended. To legitimately claim persecution, I think we have to show two things. First, malice aforethought, that a given reporter or publisher or producer is actually trying to defame us in some way, to destroy our missionary program, to run us out of town. While there are groups who have dedicated themselves to producing and providing anti-Mormon literature to the public, there are also plenty of journalists who report on church activities because that's what they've been assigned to do, and who have no deeper motives. The other factor that would suggest genuine persecution is that we as a church are being singled out for this treatment. A cursory look at the stories that get printed about virtually any church you can name belies that assertion. Just as we don't often see banner headlines that proclaim compassionate service hours up by 50% in Shaker Heights ward, or fathers included in Mary Miss New Beginnings program, neither do we see well-positioned stories on bingo revenues or in the local parish, or read that there has been a bumper crop of bar mitzvahs in a nearby synagogue. These items are of interest to local congregations and may be reported in local church newsletters, but they do not make news. What does make news is seldom complimentary to any denomination. I have read in the last several months articles on the graying of Christian Science, suggesting that this religious movement is losing its young people. I have read of a number of priests charged with molesting young Catholic boys. All that celibacy always has seemed a bit unhealthy. Do such articles indicate that religious denominations in question are being persecuted? I hardly think so. And we would, I think, dismiss charges to the effect as pure paranoia. It seems perfectly logical to us to look for answers and explanations in the Quran if something happens in the Arab world that we don't understand. No one thinks of that as anti-Muslim persecution. It is simply an attempt to shed some light on a perplexing issue for most people. But somehow when it's Mormons in the news, when the Book of Mormon is... then figure out what to do about changing those perceptions if they are not. Interestingly, she illustrated her premise with the rather widely held but totally erroneous perception that the Mormon Church is itself a cult. She had encountered this perception quite by chance in a private conversation and had spent some time reading up on cults. Every book she found on the subject at least mentioned the church in passing. Many devoted considerable space to the assertion that the Mormon Church is one of the major cults in America. As she continued her research, she learned that cultologists, or whatever such experts call themselves, have more or less agreed upon 14 characteristics that generally typify cults, and she spent considerable time matching up public perceptions of the Mormon Church with those characteristics. And she found plenty of dissonance. Just one example. The first five items on the list have to do with control. Mind control, control of time, personal property, and so on. Lou cited a number of references to support the assertion that I am sure we would all here agree upon, that Mormons believe in something called free agency. Indeed, Mormons consider free agency to be central to their theology. Free agency is to die for. There was a war fought in heaven over free agency. Casualties were high. And yet, when questioned about the issue, the vast majority of those she contacted outside the church didn't have that perception at all. They perceived the Mormon Church as incredibly controlling, as an institution that very definitely limited the agency of its members. Her methods were admittedly far from statistically reliable, yet her findings are not very surprising and could very likely be corroborated in a more tightly structured survey. So here we have what appears to be a public relations problem, a theological commitment to a principle and a public perception of just the opposite. The task at hand is to find a way to correct that misperception. Clearly, we can't do very much about correcting misperceptions if we don't know what people think of us. Maybe the place to start is to listen to what they say, or possibly to read what they write about us. Listen and read with some degree of objectivity, we can help deal with the misperceptions that will inevitably occur with an institution as large and as complex as our church has become. Interestingly, however, when Lou performed an in-house survey asking some Mormons she knew about their perceptions of the free agency issue, her findings were similar to what she had found in her non-member group. Many avowed and card-carrying Mormons she talked to perceived that their own church limited, in many ways, their own free agency. When even devout Mormons share in the misperception, perhaps the problem is more than one of perceptual dissonance. Is it perhaps true that many Mormons feel entirely free to do exactly what they're told? This leads, of course, to the possibility that while we are examining an issue for perceptual dissonance, the perceptions will be found to be valid, and the problem elsewhere. I hope it is not presumptuous to suggest that in the past 2 decades, negative press has sometimes served to show us where problems do, in fact, exist that merit our attention. During the 70s, for example, it became increasingly difficult for church members to respond individually and institutionally to charges of racism. We were, in fact, practicing a kind of spiritual apartheid that had troubled many of us. The changes in institutional and individual response to this issue have been nothing short of phenomenal for those of us who remember what it was like before. And I can't help wondering if the timing of these changes hasn't been affected by the very negative image we found ourselves projecting prior to the announcement on June 8, 1978, that all worthy male members of the church could now hold the priesthood. That this change would one day come, we had all been assured. But my generation of missionaries, speaking face-to-face with general authorities in the temple, were told, "Not in my lifetime, young man, or yours." And they were further counseled to avoid the seat of Cain in their proselytizing efforts. The issue was one of interest, but not of great concern to most Mormons. And it wasn't until later that we began to hear more equivocal and more hopeful answers to questions about the priesthood and temple ordinances for members of the church who are black. For a period of time, the pressure from outside the church was constant and was intensified by publications within the church questioning the theological foundations of the policy and calling for a change. Perhaps that 1978 announcement was not a direct response to such media-generated pressure. Perhaps the timetable had simply always been misunderstood. But the public relations crisis surely had an impact. It demanded that we examine thoughtfully a situation that was in need of change. Whether or not we like to admit it, it pointed the way to repentance. Our response to various women's issues has not been as dramatic, not at least on an institutional level, but changes are beginning to occur. Special women's conferences, a garden full of statues glorifying women's roles, may be thought of as mere window dressing, but they do represent an acknowledgement that women's issues exist. Speaking from my own experience alone, I can say that it is a great deal easier to be an active Latter-day Saint woman now than it was 15 or even 10 years ago, especially for those of us who are a bit off the beaten track. The track to which I am referring is, of course, that eternal round that leads from the kitchen to Relief Society to primary and pretty much back to the kitchen without passing go to collect a paycheck or stopping off anywhere along the way to drop off a child for daycare. When I left my daughter, now a high school freshman, at 5 weeks old, to go back to the classroom, I had either the scorn or the maudlin sympathy of virtually every sister in my ward. Relief Society met in the daytime, and I was necessarily excluded from activity or association with the main body of the ward sisterhood. Now, well over half the women in our ward work outside their homes, and those who don't tend to care for the children of those who do. There is an attitude of mutual support that is as refreshing as it was unaccustomed in the 1970s. I am fully aware that Ezra Taft Benson has spoken out against the economic decisions many families are making today, and has urged young mothers to stay at home with their children, whatever the cost. But this is one time when the prophet has spoken, and the debate has only begun, at least in my stake. The March issue of the Ensign ran a 4-page article on child care this year. More and more, we are seeing and hearing church leaders who urge young women to take their education seriously and to prepare themselves for the economic realities of the future. More attention is being paid, in meaningful ways, I hope, to single, widowed, and divorced women, and more efforts are being made to include various lifestyles within this very family-oriented church of ours. It seems to me that men are more reluctant to voice dictatorial or chauvinistic views, if they still harbor such, than they once were. I haven't found myself and women like me the subject of a diatribe from the pulpit for quite some time now. There is much that remains to be done, and I'm sure more in some wards and stakes than in others, but we have made a start. Again, I suggest that all the attention generated by the ERA issue, by Sonia Johnson's excommunication, force church members in family groups and in relief societies and in quorum meetings throughout the church to take a hard look at the real status of the average Mormon woman in the church. Either that or stand proudly convicted of what in the media we had been accused. Now we face yet another barrage of criticisms. This time the issues seem to be twofold. That the Mormon theology and Mormon church somehow creates people who are trained to act without thinking on the say-so of anyone they accept as a religious authority over them, and that our theology and culture somehow encourage or condone violent acts if they are undertaken for a higher purpose. While we are defending ourselves against such unfounded charges, we may want to ask ourselves a few questions on the off chance that there are some issues that need to be confronted. How do we understand the principle of obedience? What do we mean by words like sustain and support? How do we teach that principle when we are called upon to do so to our children, to other church members in our capacity as teachers and leaders? How much individual responsibility do we expect of ourselves and of others when it comes to following the brethren? And what about violence? Are we troubled by the numerous acts of violence we witness daily on television? Are we more concerned with, say, an R rating because we feel it is likely to indicate explicit sexual content than because a movie may have scenes of explicit violence? How do we present stories with violent overtones from the Old Testament and the Book of Mormon to our children or to classes we may teach? How do we feel about them ourselves? How glib is our justification of the shedding of blood? How do we feel about pacifists? I know of at least two conscientious objectors to the Vietnam War who were nearly hounded from the church during the 1970s by ward members who equated Mormonism with unquestioning patriotism, and I have often wondered how representative their experience was. How do we deal with war and military service generally in our conversations with others? Do we ever think past the familiar platitudes of patriotism? There are other questions to be raised, but these suggest a place to start. In the final analysis, I think our church will be judged far more by who we as individual church members are and by what we do in our places of work and in the community than by anything that our friends and associates read in the paper. As long as we have confidence in ourselves, in our theology, in our testimonies, in our community of believers, it is unbecoming for us to become overly defensive when we are criticized. We can do more for the church we love by listening and learning. It goes without saying, I hope, that we need to be well informed as citizens of the kingdom of God and as citizens of the world at large. We need to be aware of what's going on, and we need to know our own history. In the long run, we may be able to do more to enhance the image of Latter-day Saints by simply living decent and generous lives than by anything we say. This premise bears out in small, quiet, unobtrusive individual ways, and I think would work on a larger scale as well. On Monday, April 30th, the Plain Dealer reported on the first of a number of scheduled media events that had been designed to combat this negative press that we had received since the cult killings had been reported. They reported that 3,000 Mormons had gathered the previous day in the opulent State Theater in Playhouse Square to extol the values of the Christian family. Featured speakers had included Corey Snyder of the Cleveland Indians, Steve Young, quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, and Charlene Wells Hawks, former Miss America, all Latter-day Saints and proud of it. I myself was unfortunately unable to attend because of a conflict with the East Coast Sunstone Symposium that had me out of town that weekend. There was a backlash with this particular report, as it turned out, because over half of the coverage referred to the Lafferty or to the Lundgren situation again and just sort of echoed all of that and mentioned how interesting it was that all these Mormons got together and didn't talk about this. The tone of the whole article was, I thought, very patronizing. I'm told that activities like these do bring results. I'm told that inquiries soar and that missionaries get very busy for a period of time after a telecast or a conference such as this. Perhaps. I'm pragmatic enough not to want to argue with success. But I also can't help wondering if we could generate as much publicity by actually doing something besides grandstanding. Take a look at the building schedule of almost any Catholic parish or Protestant church, and you will see public service activities of all kinds scheduled throughout the week. Daycare, rummage sales, support groups of all kinds, musical rehearsals, and more. Our buildings sit virtually vacant almost 6 days of most weeks. Early in April, it was announced on radio, television, and in all the local newspapers that two Clevelanders were in need of bone marrow transplants and that a satisfactory match had not been found within their families or among donors then registered. The public was invited to donate blood samples to be typed and cataloged for these and other patients with similar needs. This massive public screening was held at Park Synagogue. During one afternoon, over 2,000 people stood in line and hung around for nearly an hour each, filling out forms and leaving blood samples. The Red Cross did the actual work of drawing and typing the blood, but the Reformed Jewish congregation donated their building. I doubt they were looking for converts. They certainly found friends and a spot on the evening news and in the morning paper. Why, I wondered, and this question cuts two uncomfortable ways, why didn't we think of that?
We'll now hear comments from David Nipper. He's a member of the local RLDS congregation.
I'm going to tell you something about myself, because how I'm going to respond to this is tell you my feelings, and I'd like for you to know a little bit about me. I have Idaho roots. I was born in southern Idaho, and I moved to Utah with my family, my wife, and two children in 1963. So we've lived here in Utah a long time. I think it adds up to about 27 years. I'm a business owner. We have an insulation contracting company in Salt Lake City. We have one in Mesa, Arizona, Baltimore, Maryland, Charlotte, North Carolina, and several cities on the west coast of Florida. Many of my businesses that I have are more successful than the one that I have here in Salt Lake City. And I have a lot of pressure to move away sometimes. But I enjoy living in Salt Lake City. I'm a member of the Reorganized Latter-day Saints Church. My connection to that is my great-grandfather was a member. I'm comfortable as a member of the Reorganized Latter-day Saints Church living here in Utah. I avoid the "we don't believes" that the church members of our past in the Reorganized Latter-day Saints Church have participated in. And I think I'm quite typical of Reorganized Latter-day Saints that feel comfortable in this religion now. I do a lot of traveling. I'd never get involved in a direct question that says, "What are the differences?" And I get that quite often. I feel comfortable in discussing what I do believe. I have some formal certitude about that. It includes that the central theme that Jesus Christ, about the only thing different between the gospel of Jesus Christ and all of the Eastern religions, including Islam, is that Christ offers forgiveness. And I hope that I can, by being in this community, I can offer forgiveness, and those who I come in contact will forgive me if I offend them in any way. I find myself defending the LDS Church more often than I do my own. As I travel, I am asked quite often, "Are you a Mormon?" My first response to that is always, "Why do you ask me that question?" "Well, you're from Utah. You must be a Mormon." And I always respond by saying, "Thank you for the compliment." It puts all the fire of the negative questions that they might have out, and I have a chance to tell them that I am very comfortable living in Utah, and I find myself telling them what a nice time I've had raising a family in Utah. I also have the questions that are asked of me then, "Do you have more than one wife if you're from Utah?" All the false perceptions that come from outside of the area, and how there's almost a general ignorance about the LDS Church. What is it like living with all those Mormons? I get to answer that. And it gives me a chance to defend the Mormons at that time, because I like living here. And then the question, how do you do business without being a Mormon in Utah? So that tells something about me. I would like to... another thing that I do a lot of is I'm involved in two or three national organizations that represent our trade, and have been the past national president of an organization that defends our trade, the insulation contracting business. I spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C. About Jeff Lundgren, there is a great break in our church that about, and it's simply a difference of as it's identified by those people who are of the Jeff Lundgren side. They call themselves conservatives and all others liberals. They have put that title on there. Bill has stated he's changed his paper a little bit. I got his first draft, but he stated in his first paper that he in this book that he's writing that he's found that there are 200 different groups. It's odd to say that one of those groups is listed in Salt Lake City, and the man who is listed as the leader I have not seen in the RLDS church in the 10 years that I've lived right here in Salt Lake City, or I've only seen him once in the 27 years that I've lived in Utah and attended in Ogden previous to that, attended church in Ogden. Bill states that 15% of the members of the Reorganized Latter-day Saints Church have divided themselves philosophically from the mainstream RLDS churches. RLDS church. I find that there are, as Rebecca stated, there are phenomenal changes in almost all growing, living organizations. And there are those in our church who feel uncomfortable with the change that they see taking place. And probably the straw that broke the camel's back was the change in of Section 156 as it was accepted by our General Conference that allowed women in the priesthood. And that was the main thing that set them apart. But I find that most of the people that have broken apart had other complaints and had become somewhat disaffected previous to that. This is their latest theme of disaffection. Those that are afraid or uncomfortable with this change soon find out by studying history that the church has been in constant change, so they usually have to draw a line of where they want to believe the beliefs of the past and that. Jeff Lundgren in Bill's paper stated that they didn't even believe that the Mormons should have ever, or the church should have ever left and went west of Kirkland, Ohio. And so that's where they drew back, they draw all the way back into the Doctrine and Covenants, those doctrines that were previous to Kirkland. And so that's the portion of the Doctrine and Covenants that they now accept. Among all other prophets that have had any input into the Doctrine and Covenants past that, they have conflict with. Conflict with the leadership this causes them in the present day RLDS church. They blame almost everything that's happened that might happen to our history, and maybe even they stated that they felt that there would be a great earthquakes that come and show that they were right. There's a great polarization. Bill's paper states quite unequivocally that polarization that they felt. By the way, I appreciated Bill's paper because it's just a narrative of the facts, and that's Bill Russell. That's the way he writes. And I'm anxious to see his book because he puts very little emotion. He puts just facts down as he can find them, and he does an awful lot of work to get these facts. Now, the question comes up about a cult. The RLDS is a cult, and I find that if in fact someone wants to call another group a cult, they'll find a reason for doing that. Although we might find a, you know, and we who are in that group can easily argue our way out of being a cult. It's kind of like some of the justifications for that are make about as much sense as the sense that would come from on every boat, there's a port and an aft. Port wine is red. Red is represented by communists. All boats are communist. So you can find those kind of reasons for someone calling another one a cult. It's easy to call anyone whom you don't believe in a cult. I believe neither the RLDS nor the LDS church are cults, and I don't have that list of 15 things, but I believe that we invite all into our fellowship, and I believe we commit ourselves to the communities that we live in, and I believe that true cults don't do that. They set themselves aside in a way that would not allow someone to come into their midst or would not allow them to participate in the community in an active, healthy way. At first, when this news came, and I'm going to tell you my feelings that came when that happened. I thought that was a way to respond to this to Bill's paper, because he was very factual about it. And I'm going to tell you how I felt, how it made me feel, the reporting of this made me feel. At first, I wanted to, as I got the phone calls from my friends all over the United States and asked me the question, what about this? And believe me, very few people that I do business with don't know what church I belong to, because I'm not ashamed of it, and I really enjoy talking about the gospel of Jesus Christ as I see it. What about this nationally televised and locally thing? The calls would say, what about this Kirkland deal, they would say. What do you think about this? Phone calls from people whom I hadn't heard from for years. And all of a sudden there was an excuse. Oh, Dave's a member of that church. Let's ring him up here and find out what he thinks about that, you know. Different excuses to hear from people, and then the people that I hear from regularly asking me. At first, I felt a little guilt. Kirkland. All of us know that we have that we're involved in the Kirkland Temple, and it must have something to do with the RLDS people. And I feel guilty somewhat. I felt a little bit of guilt about the schism in the church, and I'm hurt by that some. Some of it I don't understand. But at first, I felt guilt. And then, the next thing, I probably felt the same as many people who are here or all Mormons feel. I wanted to distance myself from it when they heard of the Singers and the Lafferty's and the Hoffmans and the LeBarons. And I thought, now I know how they feel. When there seems to be almost everything you read, maybe you think and you justify that it's a little bit unfair. Sometimes we have a tendency to blame the press, and maybe sometimes the press needs blaming. But first of all, we must know that we as American people thrive on bad news. If you saw a car wreck on the freeway during the day and drove past it, you'll probably slow down to see if you could see if anyone was hurt. And then you'll be searching the newspaper tonight to see the article about that person who was hurt. We thrive on bad news. We are entertained by bad news. And so maybe it's our fault. But the press knows what sells. I always remember the time when we in Salt Lake City ordained the first women to the priesthood, and how the press gathered around our chapel. There were almost as many press people there as there were members of our church there that day. All three local television stations came, and almost every radio station and newspaper sent people there together. And I noticed how they would they tried to interview every one of the members as they came and ask them what do you think about this? And if you said, if any of the members said, well, we think it's great, you know, well, they just go to the next person until finally they found the person they were looking for. They found one person who was violently against ordaining women into the priesthood. The one person that we had in our congregation who was violently against it, and the press lined up to interview him. And the newspapers that night quoted him many, many times. Absolutely looking for the bad news or something that was controversial, and that's what makes news. I have an idea that the first, that when the press in the Cleveland first found out about this and they were able to attack the LDS church, as they did, and the first news I heard of it, by the way, I was in Washington, D.C. when I first heard of this paper, of this this story, and it said a member of the Mormon church. And I just now imagine that they thought, oh, what a jewel. We have someone, you know, some way to attack. And of course, they were soon defused by that. I noticed that in the Salt Lake papers, and I have a collection of all, I have friends that sent me these from all over the country. When they'd ask me, I says, send me any newspaper articles from your area. I have, in the Independence area, who I have friends there that sent me all the clippings from the Independence and the Cleveland paper and all those papers sent me, there became a diffusion and very seldom mentioned the RLDS church because it was like it was now became Jeff Lundgren and less about the RLDS church and more with the facts. Never did happen in Salt Lake City. In Salt Lake City, every newspaper article that came out started out by RLDS. That's the way you catch people's attentions here. It's a good byline. It's kind of like to create kind of the anti-feeling. I don't know whether to blame the press or to blame ourselves that good news really doesn't make good news. Then my next feeling was a little bit of acceptance of the guilt. An acceptance of the fact that a human being had strayed from good, healthy thoughts into believing that God was speaking to him in a way that would allow him to harm people. I had a lot of compassion for, especially thinking of the outlying family, the Avery family that got killed. And by the way, there's a member of our church here in Salt Lake City who were good friends with the Averys and had met them. And I feel the pain that they had from this. By the way, I will tell you that I am presently what we term as the pastor, or would be like the bishop of the Salt Lake City branch of the RLDS Church. I'm the pastor of the Salt Lake City Church. And had as my job to try to calm and to attach some love. I would have liked to have avoided all the articles that I saw written. But the feelings I have, and knowing, and I know so well the feelings that all of you had, all of the RLDS, or all of the LDS people and the people from Utah have, when we are maybe known as a bunch of crazies because singers and the Laftertys, Hoffmans and the LeBarons hit the newsstands. I think we need to avoid making such judgments and attach ourselves to some of the problems that are involved with those people who feel separated. I don't pretend to understand what happened between Jeff Lundgren and his association at church, but I do know that those people in our church, in the RLDS church, who refuse to change into a kind of people like our prophet is trying to lead us into, be a loving, kind, gentle people, feel uncomfortable because in the past we have been a controversial people. And instead of saying, here's what I believe, we have been more of the kind of people who would say, here's what we don't believe. The people that have anti-Mormon thoughts don't feel comfortable in the RLDS church anymore. We talk more about what we have in common now. And I think that Rebecca told me that when she approached a person who belonged to our church 10 years ago, he distanced himself from her immediately when she said, we have so much in common, and that's true. We have so much in common with our history. I'd like to read to you a letter. It was a news release that was released to the Kansas City Star, and it also was later on printed in our monthly periodical for our church called the Saints Herald. And Roger Yerington, who is the manager of the editor of the Saints Herald, wrote this. And this was done at the request of the First Presidency. The tragic murders recently discovered in Kirkland, Ohio, have been reported extensively in the press in the past few days. Many of the reports have used the word cult to describe the small, secretive, tightly controlled group led by Jeffrey Lundgren. It is entirely appropriate to apply the term cult to such a group. Followers of Lundgren have been arrested in connection with the murders of the Avery family. The killings have been described as a ceremonial cleansing of the cult. News accounts of this terrible discovery have dwelt on the RLDS connection, pointing out that Lundgren and his followers were formerly members of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which has its world headquarters in Independence. Church authorities have reported that members of the Lundgren cult withdrew their names from RLDS membership files in 1987 and 1988. Nevertheless, the name of the church has shown up in many news stories near the term cult. For some readers and viewers of these media reports, the assumption has been that the RLDS church itself is a cult or that it spawns cults. The RLDS church has been active, open, contributing, and saints are acquainted with them and their families. We applaud the efforts of the Kirkland stake members and the Chief of Police, Dennis Yarborough, for their tireless and vigilant, although unsuccessful, effort to avert this tragedy. We trust in the loving care of the saints for each other and know that those who are suffering pain will receive ministry from their friends and congregations. We worship a gracious Lord who calls us to charity and peace. We urge the saints to support each other in this time of grief and to look for the future with hope that we may overcome this painful experience together.
This session is officially ended, but if you're welcome to stay and ask questions.